Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is an Aftershock Monday episode, and we have a friend of the show, Zach Kaplan, joining us to talk about his recently completed series, Join the Future. So, Zach, great to see you, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Join the Future, the trade just dropped. So I wanted to have you on and talk a little in depth on it. We had you on to talk about it before, and we really couldn't spoil much. Fair warning to everybody, we're going to get into some of the events and things that happen. Highly encourage you to read it. It's a great story. It's one of those things that's sort of topical with what's going on right now, but I won't bash you over the head. In fact, Zach and I were just talking about it. None of us want any quarantine or fascism content right now, but this is sort of tangentially, it's got enough of what's going on, and that's kind of typical of Zach's stuff, where it taps in just a little bit. But it's really sci-fi that just gets you thinking and has a lot of action. So we are going to go into spoilers here. If you haven't had a chance to read it, go check it out and come back and listen after you've had a chance. So why don't we remind everybody kind of what the bones of the story are, Zach, the elevator pitch, as it were.
Yeah, Join the Future takes place in the future. Mega cities have cropped up, basically, as technology has allowed cities to offer more and more opportunity and advancement to people. They've attracted more people. So now these mega cities have free healthcare, universal basic income, robots help you do all the stuff you want to do. You can get whatever job you want. It's very utopian. But a few small towns in America's rural countryside have remained, and they thrive on their self-sufficiency, and they are adverse to technology, and they just like the simple life. And it's kind of about the clash of these two worlds. Specifically, these megacities want more people, so they are selling these small towns and their citizens to come move to the big city, and these tensions reach a boiling point. And the story follows the mayor's daughter, Clementine Libby, of a small rural town in Middle America, and she finds herself in the middle of these two worlds.
Yeah, and what's great about it, like you said, it does follow Clementine. She's kind of our point of view character, and it takes this big idea that you created, you know, this idea of, you know, future versus past in a way, or you know, the new innovation versus the way that we used to do things, and also the idea of giving up some of your independence and freedom for security versus, you know, that independent kind of American spirit. All really big ideas that you can spend a lot of time thinking about. And then we kind of narrow it down through what happens, the loss and the damage that happens to Franklin, the small town that Libby's father was a mayor of. You know, she loses her father, she loses her brother. And all of a sudden it comes focused down to her choices and what she's going to do. So what made you decide to distill it down? Because you could have gone a completely different direction. You could have gone flashing back and forth between, you know, seeing people in the big city versus the small town, but you really focused and made it personal. What went into that decision?
I think the story kind of originated out of two different explorations. One was an exploration of what was happening to small town America. And this was not meant to be a red state, blue state exploration as much as just a trend that I saw happening everywhere from California to Pennsylvania to everywhere, that just, you know, metropolitan areas were growing, and the concept of living in a small town. I grew up in an Iowa small town, and this was life was changing on us. And so that was interesting to me. And the other was to do a very grounded sci-fi Western. And, the, you know, this is indicative for me of those Westerns where the railroad is coming in or civilization is coming in. And I just thought that it was more powerful seeing it through an adolescent point of view, because when you're an adolescent, you know what you know, but you haven't dealt with the complexity of life and as much as perhaps older adults have. And I thought it was interesting to look at it through the eyes of a young woman who maybe had always wondered what the city had to offer, and then finds herself up against that city. And kind of the story is really a testing story for her and her willpower, and how she can stay true to her ideals, the ideals of her family and her father, and the ideals of this small town about not embracing technology. I mean, she finds herself up against the agents and lawmen who are representing the city, and these guys are armed to the teeth with all sorts of advanced technology and jetpacks and laser beams and shields. And how do you go up against those kinds of forces without breaking your own oath and values and embracing technology? So she finds herself really in a catch-22, which is interesting. So I guess it was just all kind of that was just where my interest, you know, took me in terms of what I wanted to explore in the story.
Yeah. And really when we talk about what sort of great narrative characters people are when they're sort of at that formative age, because they don't have all the answers. Not that we do as adults, but we've lived more and we have more experiences to draw from. You know, in the beginning, we see that even Clem's brother is a little bit, you know, he's a little tempted by the technology. We see him coming with an iPod, MP3 player. He's listening to music. And even she's like, she rejects it, but just out of respect for her father almost. You know, you can see that she's not sort of sure. And all of a sudden, as things happen, it becomes galvanized. And she's even willing to, in order to get her revenge or what she considers justice, she even, you know, kind of backtracks on her father's complete rejection of technology, knowing, hey, if I want to get justice, I may have to compromise. And then we see as the story plays out that she even rejects that fully. So I think there's always something to be said. And you've written other previous stories like Lost City Explorers with kids at this age. Is that something that you really enjoy, like fleshing out and sort of life lessons of this sort of age group?
I do. I do enjoy that a lot. And I think especially I enjoy very much stories about individuals versus society and finding your way in society, especially finding your way in relationship to your dreams and your hopes and your goals and your values. And I think that something that I find that when you grow up is, you know, life tries to tell you to get rid of some of that stuff and grow up and compromise and change who you are. And young people, you know, have to find the balance between retaining who they are and perhaps reinventing themselves and not lose themselves. And I guess I just really identify with that struggle and that challenge. And so I thought, it was just something I really enjoyed exploring for Clementine. I didn't want it to be a black and white story of like, oh, the city is evil and the town is good, you know, small town good, big city bad. I think what it's more about is choice is good and limitation is bad. One of my favorite passages that I have in the story is Clementine finds this mentor character. He's a trader who lives off the land, and he's the opposite of her in the sense that he's survived by compromising every ideal and moral he has. Everything in life is available to be traded, even who you are and what you represent, as long as you live till tomorrow. And they're talking about the city and what is the city? What's really going on there? Are they eating babies? What are they doing? And he says, you know, it's not malicious or anything. It's just that you don't know what you're missing. And it's like looking up at the stars. And to me, this is the perfect analogy. For anybody who lives in a big city, you cannot see the stars because of the light bleed. You go out to the countryside where there's not light bleed and you look up and you are amazed like of how beautiful the sky is with stars. It is, I could look at a star-filled sky, nighttime sky out, you know, and the middle of nowhere for hours. It's just so breathtaking, but you don't know that you're missing that because we have lights on every street. And this is the premise of technology that comes into our lives, and it gives us one opportunity and takes away another, and you don't know you don't have that choice anymore. And so here Clementine is not even being given a choice. She's the agents of the city are coming and demanding and manipulating and forcing these people to join the future and come along for the ride into advancement in technology, and saying, don't have a choice. And it's not so much about any political aspect as much as it is about when we surround ourselves with advancement in technology and futurism, what are we sacrificing and what choice are we sacrificing?
So, yeah, it is a great line. And the way, you know, he delivers it, he's like, yeah, it's not that you're choosing not to look up anymore. You don't even think about looking up anymore because you're sucked into.
You don't know it's there.
Yeah.
You don't know it's there.
You've lost something and you don't even realize that it's missing until probably it's too late. And you're like, oh, wait, we used to, you know, it's that unrelenting march of time, that unrelenting, you know, technological advancement or societal evolution or whatever you want to call it. And it's a fascinating thing. I mean, you look back at some of the things that you and I, you know, would take for granted, like, but then you watch some like YouTube video of a couple of younger people trying to figure out how to use a rotary phone or a cassette tape or a VCR, or you got to pay your long distance bill, you know?
I mean, the concept of phone calls.
Yeah.
Of, you know, calling people and talking to people on the phone for hours, which has been altered to be a series of short exchanges over text message and social media and DMs and, you know, privacy issues and data issues and how we view our relationships with one another. And, you know, there's all at every point, you know, Amazon box is coming to our door. You can take any new advancement in society that offers convenience or one aspect, but takes away something else. And I think that they're all good and bad. I mean, I am not living in the woods by any means. I am modern, but at the same time, I think that there's value in making those choices, or at the very least recognizing that there are stars that we are not looking at every night, and we should be appreciative that they're there, even if we have sacrificed the chance to see them. And to forget that they're even there is a tragedy. So
I do sort of wonder about, you know, when this story started coming out, it was before this, you know, crazy lockdown or whatever. And when I first started reading it, I got to tell you, Zach, I was totally on the side of, you know, not in terms of the justice of what happened to the town of Franklin and Clementine's family. Obviously, you know, the city, the agents of the city coming in and taking it over by force and not giving the people the choices is never going to be okay. But when looking at it from the aspect of, I wonder, what would I choose? Would I choose to live out, you know, in the wilderness and have my freedom, or would I choose to be in the city? And I was completely on Clementine's side, right? And then when the issue 5 came out, I went back and I reread from the beginning, and I found myself not to say I would 100% be on the side of the city, but I think because of basically it's the health thing, you know, the pandemic, I'd be like, man, you know, healthcare and a little more security, I think maybe I'm would be on that side now. I don't know. What about you? I mean, you presented both sides, but where do you think you would, you know, if you lived in the world of Join the Future, which side do you think you'd be on?
Well, I would definitely live in the city, but I would also admire those who chose to live in the small town. And I think that for me, it was important not to demonize either choice. That's to me the way you get the kind of reaction that you have, Jace, where you are asking yourself, what would I do? If it's too much of a black and white obvious choice, you're not going to get that experience. And so I think that saying, well, what would I do? Would I live in the city or would I live in the town? Which is better? And then wondering what you want for Clementine creates drama for the story. And that's to me what excites me about this story and about going through this experience with Clementine, because you don't know if she should be fighting for this way of life or not. You kind of go, well, she could maybe have a good life. And it was important for me, even at the moments where the villains are clearly villainous and trying to force her to make choices. There's another great moment where this agent, who's this really salesy, swarmy kind of guy in a, you know, he's wearing a coat and tie in the middle of this dusty landscape. But he said to her, you know, we're doing you a favor because you're going to go live in the city. And 50 years from now or 100 years from now, you're going to be a nurse or a teacher or a doctor or a baker, and you're going to be in love, and you're not going to think twice about how you got here. And it's totally true. It's totally true that, you know, Clementine could go live a wonderful life in the city and she would forget all about this experience and that she was forced into it. But that doesn't mean that that's what's right for her. What, you know, she's not making that choice, that she should at least in this moment have that choice. And so I like the, you know me, Jace, I like Port of Earth has got complexity and Eclipse has got complexity in the term that you don't know which everything, one minute it seems bad and then it could be good. I like that aspect in stories, and for me, Join the Future was no different.
So it does end in such a way that it's open for more. Do we know yet if there's going to be more? Are you still hopeful for that, or where are we at there?
I would very much enjoy telling more. I think that the story is ripe for further exploration. At this time, it seems that this is where we're leaving it. But I, you know, you never know in comics and you never know in storytelling. So I certainly, we're going to continue talking about it, Aftershock and Peter and myself, and we'll continue to see what the appetite is for the series. And perhaps one day we'll come back to it. But as of now, you know, there's no plans. The reality is these things are based on, more than just our appetite for telling more story. You know, the series came out in the middle of a pandemic. It's done really well. We've been super excited about the response, but at the same time, you know, you respond to the way the retailers are operating and all sorts of things. And we're still at a very uncertain moment in the comic book industry. And so it's hard to dive right into a second arc. So if everybody out there has enjoyed the series, I thank you very much. We are not, you know, letting it go. We'll still consider it, but as of now, it is a standalone one arc series right now.
Well, hopefully the timing it will be right later to bring it back, because you know, much like Eclipse, which is, you know, this great kernel of an idea that we really saw how it affected, you know, one part of the country being New York City. There's a whole, you know, wider world to explore, and it's the same thing here, you know, with Join the Future. There's so much of a wider world, seeing the way, you know, other people, you could totally flip it on its head and do a story where somebody saved by going to city. I mean, that's the fact with the traitor's son. You know, you mentioned he compromised. That all started with his son needing the polio vaccine, if I remember.
Cancer, I think, or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You hear the traitor's story and how he was, he was the mayor of one of the biggest towns in the Midwest, and he encouraged everyone to sell out to a larger city, which kind of started this whole process. And he did it to save his son, who could only get the medical care he needed in the city. And you hear that story, and you kind of say, "Of course he did. I would do the same thing." So yeah, it's a real fun, complex setup. And I would love to stay with Clementine and continue to test her and see how her commitment to her ideals holds up under more duress, under different circumstances, perhaps exposing her to the city and seeing how she handles that test. So it's a great setup, and I really loved playing in it, and I wouldn't be opposed to more.
Yeah. And you mentioned Peter earlier, Peter Kowalski, your artist, his art, man, holy cow.
I feel unbelievable.
Like this, This is sort of the most traditional, almost superhero style art that you've ever had on a book you've done. I mean, not that this is a superhero book, but I think for a lot of people, sometimes the art on independent books, it's not something they're used to, and it can be a little off-putting. That's not the case with Join the Future, everybody. I mean, this art is amazing. Can you talk a little bit about how he got involved with the project and your
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Peter Kowalski is a Polish artist. He's been making comics for 20 years. And he seems to be, in my opinion, peaking right now. I mean, he has done, he did Bloodborne. He did Sex, which was an Image comics book. He has this real Mobius level ability to create detailed landscapes. And at the same time, to really find the character and deliver a real heartfelt connection to them. I think this is a really winning combination, not seen by a lot of artists, very high level of detail and character. And he nails it. And he has formed this camaraderie and partnership with Brad Simpson, who's a colorist who's just also peaking right now. He's done everything from Coffin Bound, Crone, several fantastic creator-owned books out there. And together they just create this incredible, beautiful book. I knew that we needed a team that could capture both the sci-fi element of this very futuristic city and all the high-tech stuff that we were going to do, and then at the same time the empty kind of earthy vibes that the small town had. And it was a tall order, and they nailed it. And I'm so proud of the look of the book. I think everybody who reads it will find that it's one of the most beautiful creator-owned books of last year. If I brag about the art, they killed it.
It totally is. And that's the thing I wonder. So being that these guys were at the top of their game, I mean, at what point did you realize, like, holy crap, I really gotta deliver myself? Did you feel any added pressure?
No, I didn't feel. I constantly am trying to be the best writer that I can be. That is a separate pressure that I put upon myself, and I'm always aspiring to learn from other creators out there and evolve and grow myself as a writer. I don't think that I feel more pressure because of the quality or talent of my art team. The script that I'm going to send to any artist, whether they're a first-time artist or an artist of 30 years, if I got the chance to write a script for the biggest artist in comics, I think I would have the same amount of pressure on myself, to be honest. I can finish a script and I say, I did a good job, I feel confident, or it is what it is. Right. It's the best I can do. That's where, when you start writing a script, before it's written, it can be the best script you've ever written in the world, And when you finish, it's good enough to be done, and it's got to get going. For me, it always feels like it can be better at the beginning, and then by the end of it, you're in the weeds. You've just been chopping trees for days, and you're just like, I can't do any more to help it. It's done, and then it grows up and it becomes its own thing. And you look at it and you say, that turned out okay. That kid turned out all right. Got a couple problems like all kids, but it did pretty good. So
It'll survive. I mean, it's the potential of the blank page versus the reality of the deadline.
That's right.
Is there anything that you did script wise or plot or story wise as the story played out? Because I know that you always leave room for things to sort of change organically, but any particular scenes or anything that you did knowing that this played to the strengths of your art team? Like, you're like, man, these guys are great at, skylines or whatever. And did you change?
Yeah. I mean, I knew when I hired them that they were going to be great for landscapes. So from the get-go, once they were on board, I leaned into double page spreads and landscapes and as much world building as I could. As far as writing for the art team, I mean, you learn. It's an interesting process writing a comic. In the beginning, you it's like moving in to live with somebody that you just met, right? Mm-hmm. So you're trying to figure out who's going to wash the dishes and how you wash the dishes. And oh, you wash. I'm going to wash the dishes. Okay, how do I wash it? You dry the dishes. Oh, well, great. Well, I'll wash and you dry. Okay, here we go. You're figuring it all out, and then right. By the end, you kind of have this rhythm. You understand each other. So I'm sure there are all sorts of micro choices that I made as I wrote issue 4 that I didn't realize it, but I knew that Peter and Brad were going to be able to execute it. And Hassan Otsman Elhow is an amazing letterer. And, that's another facet, learning how good he was at sound effects and weaving conversations on the page gave me even more freedom in my scripts to kind of to say, well, this is, this is what's happening. And this sound plays throughout the scene. Hassan, can you figure it out? And, you work with your team, but it's a very subtle process. It's hard to determine exactly what.
Yeah.
And I will say, I thought you were going to ask me, Jason, what I did differently from the other projects.
Well, actually, that was on my list of things to bring up. If there was anything unique to this, either in terms of the way you built it or the way it felt or any unique challenges.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Eclipse was born out of a lot of suspense and excitement. That was a character story, but there was a lot of fast moving pieces and power politics and action and lots of set pieces in Eclipse. Port of Earth became more of a, there were lots of action set pieces there, but it was very removed from character. We were watching it through the lens of the news and the journalism, and we were supposed to be removed, which worked as a great device in that story, but it didn't give me the chance to really do a lot of character moments. Lost City Explorers began with a lot of character, but once the kids got on their adventure, there was a ton of adventure to pack into 5 issues. In fact, I think I surprised myself about how little space I actually had to do as much adventure as I wanted. So I think going into Join the Future, I knew that I really wanted to make this more of a character story than maybe all of my others and really spend time with Clementine. So I would get to scenes where, she's mourning the loss of her family after these mercenaries attack her town and her family is lost to her, and kind of saying, well, how many pages can I really spend here with her, and taking that risk of saying, well, I think the audience will stay, the reader will stay with me if we have her, walking through the bodies and just seeing her house and then burying her brother and her father and looking at the city in the distance. I mean, these are very small moments in terms of the plot, but big moments in terms of the character. And, hoping that those kinds of moments would connect the reader so much that it enhanced their story. So I was trying to spend more time with the character and with Clementine.
Well, you mentioned wanting to do a Western, obviously, a sci-fi Western, and there is that sort of romanticism in Western stories of the loner, and Clementine really spends quite a bit of time alone and not in a good way, not communing with nature or anything like that. I mean, she's isolated because she's suffered loss. So was that something that, you took from, okay, that's a Western theme and I want to be sure to incorporate it in the story?
Yeah. I mean, I knew that she was going to have this mentor character that she partnered with, but it wasn't, I knew that she wasn't going to form a posse or connect to anybody else. This was a real isolated story of her and her experience to get revenge and redemption for her family and her town against these adversaries. And the mentor was the real other character in this two-hander, and I drew a lot of inspiration from Westerns like True Grit, or Westerns where the hero is the loner who's, fighting that posse. So, yeah, it does have a lot of that. I mean, I was listening to lots of Marconi and watching lots of Westerns when I wrote this. So it all probably fed into the,
It's interesting. You mentioned the traitor as a mentor, and he certainly teaches her. But what's so interesting about their relationship is I feel like even when Clementine is with him, you know, physically with him in the same proximity as him, she's still alone. He's not a mentor in terms of, hey, we're simpatico. You know, like you yourself said, they have, you know, taken this choice and gone completely different. Clementine is all about her values and her morals. And like you said, this guy's traded all that away. They are, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum. So even when they're together.
That's the best kind of mentor-mentee relationships, to be honest. I mean, if you look at some of the most famous ones in, you know, I don't know, Yoda and Luke Skywalker, right? There's something to be said for having a mentee and a mentor that have differing life philosophies, and that they teach each other something, and that they both have a common goal. Mm-hmm. They, you know, she comes in and they strike a deal. He will teach her to shoot and handle herself, and she's gonna help him out around the camp. But they have a common goal, but a very different view of the world and how things should be handled. They teach each other something. You know, that's, to me, that's the best kind of mentor-mentee relationship. It doesn't give you a lot to go on if you have two people that see the exact same thing. She's coming to him to learn something, and then in turn, you know. So But I think you do feel like she's alone because he's really trying to push her to embrace technology and to compromise her values. So even when she teams up with him, he's not helping her soul. Right. He's just helping her mission. And you can feel that she's being pulled potentially in the wrong direction. There's a moment where she finally gets the sci-fi futuristic gun and she's firing it and it works like a charm. And I hope people read that and feel uneasy about it because it's not right for her. You know, that's not the way she should do it. That's not what it's about. One of the favorite lines I found in the story is, sometimes you just find these moments, is after she's rejected technology for the second, it's not gone well, her first attempt with the sci-fi gun, and she has to flee, and she comes back to the town to make a final stand, and she encounters him for what seems like one last time. And that exchange with them in the streets, where he basically says, you're going to go up against these guys and you're not going to use anything. You're going to just die. You know, where's your values? No one will know what happened here. And she says, you'll know, and you'll tell people about it. You know, I didn't know that was going to be the line until it came to me in the scene work. But, you know, that's the great thing about rebellion stories and stories about people who are standing up for their beliefs. It only needs to affect one other person to matter. And, you know, she's in turn impacting him. And that inspires his choices in the final climactic scenes, which set her up for success. So, I find their relationship beautiful, even though it starts really at odds. So,
it is the heart of the story for me, I think, because, you know, she's isolated even when she's with him. He's put, you know, like you said, pushing her to compromise her values like he's done. And it's not right for her. And it does mean so much. I want to talk about one more thing in terms of Clementine. I was saying that really her growth is kind of extraordinary, because like I said, in the beginning, you can see that she goes along because it's what her father feels is right, and she's scolds her brother for being tempted, and then she gets to the point where she wants to matter, and she wants her choices to matter. She's, you know, completely confident in her convictions, even to the point where the traitor may even have come around. You know, she may have you know, been the one to teach him more than he taught her. So that was a really great arc. Do you feel like you nailed that growth for her as a character?
Yeah, I think so. I'm happy with it, and I think that she has her moment, and she fulfills her destiny in terms of what
has to happen for her as she survives her testing plot, both physically and mentally and emotionally. She gives up that naive or sheltered adolescent view of accepting things simply because you're told to them, and instead she emerges embracing her beliefs as her own because she's discovered them along the way. She basically learns to make her own choice. And I think that, you know, for me, it was very fulfilling. I have a young daughter. She's 6 years old. And I thought about her a lot when writing this, the kind of, you know, what I hope all young girls will be able to find reading this whenever they're it's appropriate, but right. You don't give up, you know, you stay true to who you are and you make it your own, and you fight your way through life, and you know, life will kick you and beat you up at times, but you don't forget who you are, and that's and you make a choice. Even if you're making a compromise, it's your choice, and you stay true to it. So I think there's a lot of value in that kind of identity, and an identity of grit and ideals. So
yeah, and it's important. It's an important lesson to remember, even if you know, or if you're old like us.
Well, yes. Well, we all live vicariously through the character, even if they're a 6-year-old boy or an 80-year-old woman. So, yes.
Yeah, it's good to be reminded. What about reader reaction? How do you feel that it was received overall by your, because you're really starting to have a pretty decent fan base here. You got people that are coming back regardless of where you're writing the series. Is it coming out of Aftershock or somewhere else?
I'm very happy. I got a lot of fantastic reviews and great response on it. People who really dove in loved it. And I think for the most part, you know, we launched back in March, right as the pandemic was beginning. We had a fantastic first issue, just really over the moon with how the first issue did. And then we had to delay the series 2 or 3 months. And we came back in the summer. And you know, things were just different, and I'm happy with the way it did. We came out with the trade right in the middle of the election and everything that's been going on here. And so, you know, it's 2020 was a weird year to be releasing a comic book and to be making comics. And I took it all in stride. I was very happy that people who found it loved it, and I'm hoping that as we make our way through some of the tough times that we've had, that more people will continue to find it. And
So what about any other upcoming projects? I know you have things in the work, but nothing you can talk about. But what about things in other media? I know the whole TV and film industry was kind of shut down. You had multiple projects at, you know, at multiple places. Things starting to gain momentum again?
Things are, you know, we're just waiting to hear things, the development process for comic book adaptations into television is very long. It takes a while. And I think studios are especially sitting on material right now. It's hard for them to segue into production. So they are waiting as long as they can, but I do expect to get a lot more headway as we go into this year, as things are continuing to look better. And as for comic book projects, I had a lot of things that just had to move from 2020 to 2021. But as a creator, I'm very busy, working very hard, and I'm excited to bring new stuff when it's ready.
So. Yeah. Now I've talked to a lot of creators over the past 8 months, and they've said, well, yeah. You know, take advantage of I've been taking advantage of, just not that my life has changed that much. I'm usually a homebody anyway. It's the way most creators tend to be, introverts and that sort of thing. But they've really been buckling down and getting ahead on things on projects, whether they have a home or not. Has that been the case for you? Have you been able to get a lot of
Well, yeah. At the same time, I've got two young children at home. And so 2020 has been a year of survival. And, you know, I've taken my my time to work when I have it. But I think it's a really exciting time. I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm very optimistic about the comic book industry. I saw even in 2020 that graphic novel sales were up 1/3 than the year before. I think we still have a growing industry. I think people are going to be more excited than ever to get back to comic book shops en masse, to get back to conventions. We're in a renaissance of comic book storytelling. There's more publishers emerging every year. The appetite for original stories that push the limits is like nothing I've ever before. Technology is making the artwork more accessible and better. You know, it's just everything is the sky's the limit for comics, and I am here to bring as many great stories as I can, and I'm excited about everything I'm working on. I wish I could talk more about it, but it's all secretly locked away in the tank, being cooked, and you know, here's to the future.
All right. Well, we look forward to finding out what some of those projects are. Knowing you,
you'll be the first to know, my friend.
Yeah, you always manage to tickle my imagination. I'll put it that way. So as we wind down here, Zach, you want to remind everybody where they can find you online. I know you like being a part of.
So I'm not. Yeah. And, let me know if you pick up Join the Future and you enjoy it. Let me know whether you live in the city or the small town and what you took from it. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Zach Kapp, ZACKKAPS. And thank you guys.
Great. And everybody, I'll put links to Zach's social media in the show notes. So if you're having trouble finding him, you can go there and click and find him. So, hey man, great to see you. Great to catch up. Love to Join the Future. And yeah, look forward to more work from you as always.
Thank you very much, Jace. Have a good one.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening as always. We'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.